Okay, hi everybody. Thanks a lot, Jordan, for introducing us, and thanks. It's nice to be here with this great panel, and thanks everybody for being here on this beautiful day inside to talk about Occupy. The title of my talk that, can you all hear me if I'm sitting or should I get up? Yeah? Okay. The title of my talk that Asher asked me to send in, and I don't think it made it in anywhere, is The Breakup, Strategy in Occupy After Occupy. So that's what I'll be talking about. I was a marginal participant inside of Occupy Wall Street here in New York City, and also an observer of Occupy. And as an academic or as a scholar, I was interested in comparing what was going on with Occupy to what was happening with the New Left in the 60s, and the book that I will now shamelessly self-promote takes this up a little bit in its introduction and conclusion, and you all can pick it up upstairs after this talk. But I also worked with two of my colleagues at the Murphy Institute, Stephanie Luce and Ruth Milkman, on a project called Changing the Subject. And this, unlike my book, is free and comes with nice pictures. So you can pick this up if you're interested afterwards. But this report is a report based on interviews that we did with 25, many of whom were core organizers of Occupy Wall Street here in New York, and also a survey that we did a year ago this week at the May Day Rally 2012, where we interviewed, with the help of a lot of graduate students and other people who helped us out on the project, some of whom I know are here at the conference, we interviewed 729 participants who were both core activists as well as supporters of Occupy Wall Street. And the work that I'm doing now is a continuation of that work. I've continued to interview some of the folks who are still doing Occupy after Occupy. And my goal in this talk is really to kind of get inside of the headspace of the organizers themselves and try to understand what they themselves are doing and thinking. So the three main lines of questions that I've been bringing to the interviews and that I want to explore in my own work. One has to do with strategy. How or do the activists today see their work as fitting into a goal of social transformation? Barbara Epstein has a piece in Socialist Register that looks a lot at Occupy Oakland, and one of the things that she argues in there is that a lot of the occupiers that she was looking at, she was meeting with, working with, talking to, but then ultimately kind of reflecting on, had as their goal resistance as opposed to transformation. And she saw as a problem in the movement this kind of resistance being the end goal as opposed to having a broader vision of how are we going to affect social change. And I'll just say that this might be an effect of the snowball sample that I've been working from, but that hasn't been my experience in New York. That the conversations I've had with the activists I'm speaking to, people are very interested in the question of strategy and trying to figure it out. And this, kind of hangs over my whole talk here. One organizer said to me, I don't know what we can do to win. And I think there's a real looking for what should we do. The second question I'm talking to people about is organization. Where are they on organization? I'm sure many of you are familiar with the debates that took place during Occupy, which had a lot to do with horizontalism, which was the kind of expressive organization that the occupations themselves took, and a kind of critique that was leveraged by the forum itself and by many of the people practicing it against vertical or hierarchical forms. But there was an experienced frustration with some of the limitations of horizontalism that have to do with how do you get up to scale on certain questions, how do you link up with others, how do decisions get made. And there's been an experimentation with form as a result. There have been questions about centralized versus local activity. And another thing that I'll just say here, and I'm not actually going to get much into, is there's a real critique of what they're calling the nonprofit industrial complex. People are very, the organizers I'm speaking with are very critical of being paid by foundations to do social change work, and feel like on the one hand they can't find good jobs, but they also don't want to take the jobs that they maybe could get, because they, and this is a quote from someone, we can't be relying on the people who are benefiting from the system to fight against it, right? So there's part of an organizational question is also this question of self-funding, right? And this is where the relationship between the Occupy forums and labor organizations, which is where I come out of, and that's where I work at the Murphy Institute. I mean, I work with unions, and that's what I mostly think about. But, you know, unions are self-funded organizations, and they are, to some degree, not nearly as much as we would like, necessarily democratic as a result of the self-funding nature of unions. And the question I think that many of the Occupy organizers are asking themselves is, how do we self-fund? How do we be member-based? How do we make it so that the resources that fund the work that we need come from ourselves and not from the Ford Foundation or something like that? The final question I've been talking to people about, and again, I'm not going to talk too much about this today, is the question of really realizing the 99%. One of the findings in our report is, you know, which I don't think should come as a surprise to anybody, is the real demographic limitations of core Occupy activists. The majority that we found, or it's a majority, but also the disproportionate core was drawn from white people in their 20s and 30s, slightly more male than female, and very highly educated, which does not necessarily correlate with having come from an elite background, but at this point, you know, college educated, frequently post-college educated. And so there's a question of, you know, how are the activists themselves interested in broadening the base and the activities that they are still working in order to kind of transform both where they're working, who they're working with, the nature of the work that they're doing. Okay. So back to my title, The Breakup Strategy in Occupy After Occupy. How much time do I have?
You're doing well.
Okay.
10 minutes.
I've done 10 minutes already?
You only have 7 minutes.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, so when I talk about the breakup, I'm talking in part, I think, obviously about the breakup of Occupy, right? And putting, you know, the question is like, what are we putting it back together to? Is it being put back together? Should it be put back together? But the other side of the question of the breakup comes from a picture, which is my favorite. It's probably my favorite thing about this entire report. And you guys really can't see it, but I have it. So this says here, it says, "Dear capitalism," it's my favorite sign, "it's not you, it's us." Just kidding, it's you. So this sign, it's like, it's the breakup with capital. It's the breakup note to capitalism, right? And it's the walking out the door kind of gesture of the movement. And it makes me think about, well, you know, what's involved with a breakup from capitalism? Can you just break up from capitalism? Can you just delink and say, you know, see you later? And when I think about the strategy, which is the thing I want to talk about today, you know, I think that's the daunting, overwhelming challenge, problem, you know, elephant in the room that a lot of these anti-capitalist occupiers are coming up against. So I'm just going to say something that many observers have said, and I think is very clear from our report, that one of the great, amazing things to come out of Occupy was the extent to which people were experimenting and asking questions and exploring. And they were trying a lot of new things, as well as a lot of things that have also been tried before. And before turning to the post-occupiers, I just want to say one thing, which is that a lot of what Occupy did, and I'm sure my fellow panelists will reflect on this as well, is it really galvanized many people who were not directly inside of the Occupy protests to step up their work, be more innovative, more risk-taking, to think about new allies where maybe they didn't see the allies before. And I think a lot of the amazing work that's been coming out of low-wage worker organizing and some local policy initiatives really can be traced back to Occupy. But when we come to the occupiers themselves, the biggest strategy, the biggest kind of answer coming out of the question of how do we break up with capitalism is, and I think this should come as no surprise to anybody here, is a kind of prefigurative strategy, right? What Andre Gorz describes as bringing the future into the present. You know, creating the values of the future society that you want to see today. And I think of this kind of as like a cheating strategy, like as far as the breakup goes, like, you know, capitalism is an asshole, so like, why not have an affair? you know, it's like you're creating the new relationship in the moment. You are creating the alternative forms of your future society while capitalism is still there, right? And the mini societies of the camps, the people coming together to create the mutual aid, the free medical attention, the free education, the food, all of that, you know, was for many, many people who were involved or became a strategy, because it was a space for kind of utopic reflection. It was a space where people said, well, the world we live in doesn't have to look this way, right? And we can realize a different way of living. And it was a step. I mean, it was a tactic, obviously. The occupation is a tactic, but it became a kind of a visionary platform from which you might imagine creating actual different worlds. And I would say that Occupy Sandy, which is, I've talked to many of the people involved in Occupy Sandy, is another one of these prefigurative efforts, in that the capitalist state didn't get its act together, and the self-help and the immediate need that people needed to address, and the immediate aid people needed to have, was going to be created by Occupy, right? And they did it. And it, I have to say, that was, I think, magnificent. I mean, I think it was incredible what they managed to pull off, and we can talk more about that. But many of these alternative forms, like in after Occupy Sandy, in the Far Rockaways, there is a group right now that is doing worker co-ops, where they have, I think, 10 new worker-owned co-ops that they are helping to form, and there's like support for them and deep education about how that would work and industry analysis that they are coming together and doing. There is this guerrilla gardening, like reclaiming the land in Staten Island and in Sheepshead Bay. This is all local to New York, and there are many other examples we could talk about. For some of the people who I speak to, this is a long-term strategy, and I'll quote somebody. She said, connecting with the sectors that they come from, people are connecting with the sectors that they come from. So, and now she's talking back, you know, in the past to the occupiers. She said, like the food committee, kitchen, has connected with local farmers, and there's this whole Occupy Farms project. And I think we planted the seeds of self-management in the park, and now we're seeing the sort of flowering of that within the existing society. So I think going forward, you need to build on these connections and really build self-managed alternative infrastructure, a kind of dual power situation. That's my ultimate goal, she says, but I see it as a lifetime of work. And it's this kind of dig where you stand idea, in part, and transform the relations around you. But I will say that for other people I'm talking to, this is not seen as enough. This is seen as tactical. And there's an organization question that comes up over and over again. And I'll just quickly kind of lay out some of the organizational models that people are thinking about or have experimented with. First of all, people are talking about their own networks this kind of new network node of organization. And the idea being, and they see Sandy as being really an example of this, that you have strong local groups who are highly organized and know each other and have worked closely with each other on particular projects who can be brought together in a moment of crisis. This is the vision they have, and one that they think to some degree exists already in New York, and Sandy was an example of that. They also talk about these more local groups that they operate within as being places for deep political education. And I would say like alternative banking, I don't know if you all are familiar with that Occupy group that continues to meet, is an example of this, where they meet regularly every Sunday, they do political work, and there's also deep political systematic kind of education that's happening there. There's another group called Wildfire that's operating out of the Rockaways that is similar. They're doing kind of political organizer training, leadership development, and in many ways, I actually think it looks a lot like a kind of more politicized version of ACORN, and also similar, I would say, to the Economic Rights Action Project of SDS and the New Left. And one thing I would like to talk about, maybe in discussion we could talk about, is a little bit about the comparisons between these questions they're facing and the New Left. But another form that I think is interesting is the neighborhood assemblies that did get going and have not taken off as much as I think many of the people who have started it would like to, but there continue to be some neighborhood assemblies. And these remind me of what Bill Fletcher calls for when he talks about worker assemblies. It also actually reminds me a little bit of Gramsci's when he talks about the kind of ward organizations, you know, as opposed to factory councils, that the idea being that you're bringing people together from many different workplaces and to kind of talk locally about how the issues that you have both in your community and work intersect and relate to each other. And today, for example, Occupy Kensington has a demonstration going on right now around a local grocery store that they've been helping kind of support during a unionization struggle. None of this stuff is very big, though, so I just want to finish with this. The whole of Occupy, I would say, is no longer bigger than the sum of its parts, right? I mean, Occupy was bigger than the sum of its parts, and that's no longer the case. I mean, there is fracture. I hear from the people I'm talking to a desire for broader, more coordinated, strategic discussions as well as initiatives. And I think that they are aspiring to, or maybe I'm aspiring for them to be aspiring to this, but I think that some of them are aspiring to kind of operate within a Gorzian framework of non-reformist reforms. And I just read this with my students recently, which is why it's kind of fresh in my head, and one of my students is here, so you've read this too recently, Danny. But non-reformist reforms, according to Gorz, are determined not in terms of what can be, but what should be. They can be either gradual or sudden, but in any case, they assume a modification of the relations of power. They assume that the workers will take over power or assert a force, that is to say, a non-institutionalized force, strong enough to establish, maintain, and expand those tendencies within the system which serve to weaken capitalism and to shake its joints. So there's an aspiration for that, but there is not yet a platform for that. And I think that there is the challenges are massive, and there is enormous political education that people are doing, and there are enormous challenges that all of these occupiers in their localities are facing. But I will leave what I have to say there, and we can take up some of these questions together. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Penny, for that. We're going to be saving the questions till after all of our panelists get a chance to have their say. And next, we are going to have Frances Fox Piven, and she will begin.
Well, I think that we are, in fact, in a movement era or a movement moment, and that the scale or the shape of the era can't be judged by something we call Occupy. It takes different forms in different places, and in general, I think that we misread movements because of the metaphor that we use to describe the movement. We use the metaphor of the explosion. And by using that metaphor, we are led to think that the movement takes off, it rises in a great arc, and then it dwindles, diminishes. And I don't think that any movement in history has really taken that form. The great movements in American history have taken place over a long period of time. They have unfolded in a way which is very irregular, which is interrupted and uneven. Just look at the movements that are faintly reachable by our experience, or at least the lore that we have been told. The labor movement unfolded over a very long period of time. It perhaps peaked in the 1930s, but it wasn't over in the 1930s. It continued to be a movement in the sense that it was disruptive and it galvanized a lot of people for a very long time after its peak. Or the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement was first clearly visible in the mid-1950s. It wasn't over till sometime in the 1970s. In between, people regularly said, oh, the movement is over. Every time the lunch counter sit-ins were over, or at least they dwindled, oh, the movement's over. The freedom rides were over, oh, the movement is over. But in fact, the movement went on with these interruptions, with this kind of staccato and jerky kind of pattern, taking slightly different forms in different places, certainly different forms when the Black Freedom Movement took place in the North. It was quite different than it was in the South. Its issues were different and its forms of organizing were different. So don't rush to moan the demise of Occupy, because Occupy is part, I think, I hope, I desperately hope, of something much, much larger. And the reason that it's part of something that is much, much larger is because it arises from, it is nourished by, very, very deep fissures in modern societies and in American societies. Fissures that not only cause fierce grievances because of the broken promises and the ruined lives, but fissures, the other side of the grievances. You know, you don't get a job when you get out of school. Well, you worked hard to go to school, you borrowed money, you're finished, you don't get a job, and therefore, and you also don't get a ticky-tacky house that saddles you with a mortgage. Well, those are broken promises, but they're not just broken promises. They are also a broken system of social control. Because when you get that job, well, you may join your union, although probably not these days, but you also go to work every day. You're bound by the routine of work, by the authority system of work, by the ideology of the capitalist workplace. And when you borrow money to buy a home, you're bound by the mortgage payments you owe, by the hope you have for a more secure retirement, and so forth and so on. So it's both grievances and a breakdown of a kind of everyday, quotidian system of social control. So that's part of what's feeding Occupy, but it's not just feeding Occupy, it's fueling, and it's going to fuel, other kinds of protest among other groups in the society. The question I really want to address is why movements are so important, why we should place so much of our political work and our political faith in protest movements. Certainly they've been very important in giving us what we love about the American political economy, if we can say we love anything, well, giving us what's better about the American political economy, about American political history. It's all due to the work of movements from the Revolutionary War mobs to the abolitionists, including the black abolitionists who left the plantations by the hundreds of thousands toward the end of the Civil War, the labor movement, the populist movement before the labor movement, the women's movement, and so on. You all know that, and you know how these movements have stamped their, have made an imprint on American society, but why have they? What do movements do that makes them a force for reform and maybe for transformation? Maybe. We don't know that. That takes us to a kind of terrain that is very unfamiliar to us. Well, I think they do two things. I think movements, as the little booklet that Penny showed you said, movements are communicative. They change the subject. The way in which American politics and therefore American political culture is shaped has everything to do with the need that political elites have for avoiding issues that are divisive, that are contentious. And they have to do that in part because we have a majoritarian party system, and they have to do it in part because political elites are so closely tied to economic elites. They don't want to rock the boat. And most of the time, they succeed in doing this by defining the political agenda. And there is nothing bigger than the electoral arena, than an election campaign for telling people what the issues of politics consist in. That's how we decide. Until a big movement, a serious movement, a contentious movement comes along. What movements do in part is they raise issues that are informed by these deep grievances that people experience because American institutions are not working the way they're supposed to work. They raise the issues that political elites, that it's their business to cover up and to ignore. Occupy did that. Occupy, its distinctive genius and its contribution perhaps to this larger movement era that I'm envisioning, was that it raised issues, it was so good at formulating the issue in a way that you could sort of put it in a thimble, that you could always carry it with you, that everybody could understand, you know, the 99%, the 1%, that event where it emblazoned 99%, 1% Occupy on this, on the blank wall of this huge building in Lower Manhattan. Everybody could understand what the issue was, and everybody could identify with the 99%. Occupy did this in many ways. It did it by using the language of the occupation and replacing demonstration. I mean, we were all so tired of demonstrations. We're all so tired of these marches where everybody got on the bus at 5 o'clock. And we knew, everybody knew. They knew we'd all get on the bus at 5 o'clock. We knew we'd get on the bus. Occupy at least suggested that maybe we could do more. So Occupy was brilliant. I say was. I use the past tense, not because I think the movement is over, but because I think Occupy was a phase in a larger movement, and Occupy performed brilliantly. But by itself, communicating doesn't give a movement power. Maybe it has an effect on elections. It had an effect on this past election. Other groups, Obama in particular, started to talk a little bit differently, influenced by the issues that Occupy had raised, but it's not enough. Movements, when they have an impact on a society, it is because they exercise power. And movement power comes not just from communication, but it comes from disruption. Everybody is saying that nowadays. All of a sudden, we've recognized that protest movements are don't just sing hymns and movement songs, but they are disruptive. But what is this disruption that everybody is acknowledging? Well, it has to do with the fact that every society is a complex system of cooperation. And that cooperation, it includes everybody. It includes not only, as you know, in the Communist Manifesto, not only the workers who go to work every day and keep the system of production run, but it also includes the pedestrians on the street who obey the traffic rules. It also includes the kids who go to school every day. It includes the nannies who take care of the kids of the women who go down to Madison Avenue and Wall Street to work. It's a very complex system of cooperation, and everybody has to do their part. Everybody has to do their part, or it stops. It doesn't work. If you don't obey the traffic rules, it doesn't work. If you don't go to school, if you don't take your kids to school, if the nannies don't come to, it doesn't work. That is a kind of latent power that most people in a society have. They have the power of refusal, of refusing their ordinary roles. Now, I think that's the power that movements sometimes activate. Not usually in a thoroughgoing way, but for a time. And for particular people, in particular roles. That's the kind of power that Occupy was looking toward when it talked about strike debt. And just the idea is, to me, is almost paralyzing. It is so big. In a society where people are as indebted as we are, and people everywhere indeed are, for the thing to continue working, people have to make their mortgage payments. They have to make their credit card payments. They have to pay their student debts. This is a kind of power that people have and that they ordinarily don't see, because of course everybody pays their debts. Of course, a deadbeat is a terrible thing. And for a moment, at least, Occupy was looking at the possibility, well, they need us to pay it, but they depend on us because we've got their money, actually. It's coming out of our paycheck. It's the mortgage payments we send in every month. It's those student debts we are saddled with for 30 years of our working lives. Well, maybe we won't. Now, it was a very scary idea. I am not critical of Occupy for sort of moving on to debt jubilee and stuff like that. The reason it's so scary is because it challenges what is no doubt the most powerful institution in the world financial system. But the possibility nevertheless remains. And to me, it is an awesome possibility, and a possibility that could be enacted on a huge scale. Just this morning, I read a blog about people organizing to reclaim homes that are scheduled for eviction in Spain. You know, they're doing what people are doing on a small scale in the United States. We've got to figure out how to do that. I want to make only one more point, and that is that I do think that going from movement power, disruptive power, the power of ungovernability to a new society is a new terrain and a very difficult one for us to tackle with our sort of toolkit of ideas. I myself feel a great need to think about it one step at a time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Francis.
I prefer to stand. I would like to talk about Occupy Wall Street and the question of hegemony, Gramscian analysis, which is also the title of my more detailed analysis in the March issue of Socialism and Democracy. I have three copies for you if you are interested, and there are some more at the Socialism and Democracy table, the fifth floor. Now let me first explain briefly why I think a Gramscian framework is adequate for an analysis of Occupy Wall Street. Antonio Gramsci was the first theorist who systematically investigated the question of how the ruling classes succeed in establishing hegemony. Hegemony is more than the traditional Marxist term of class rule, class domination. In Gramsci's understanding, hegemony means that the ruling class not only has the control of the means of production and repressive apparatuses like the army, the police, the secret service, but also its hegemonic apparatus, by its ideological apparatuses and by its organic intellectuals, creates a general consensus that its rule is legitimate and beneficial. How can it maintain this general consensus despite capitalism's inherent irrationality, its recurrent economic crisis, its polarization of rich and poor, its destruction of the environment? And how can the subaltern classes, the exploited and marginalized, disrupt this imposed consensus, disrupt in a sustainable way? One could, should maybe add, how could they develop a counter-hegemony based on a broad class alliance, mainly in Gramsci's times and perception between industrial workers and the poor peasants of southern Italy? How to build an oppositional hegemonic bloc that is an attractive and appealing alternative to the powers that be? I think these basic questions of that Gramsci posed are very important, they are still very important for today when we deal with movements like Occupy Wall Street. My claim is that a Gramscian approach can account for both Occupy Wall Street's strengths and weaknesses. Such an approach looks at how Occupy Wall Street was able to disrupt the predominant ideological framework of US capitalism, how it was able to capture the imagination of so many people that had not been involved in progressive politics before. How did it tap into people's common sense and their frustration? And on the other hand, also, how to grasp analytically the limits of the movement that blocked the construction of a political alternative and a sustainable counter-hegemony so far. I very much agree with most what Francis and Penny have said in regard to the astounding appeal of Occupy Wall Street. In order to appreciate the enormous achievements of the movement, we have to compare it, or one has to compare the time before and the time after it started. Up to mid-September 2011, it seemed to be set in stone that the Tea Party was the only vibrant and expanding social movement in the US. The experience that the Obama administration organized huge bailouts for big banks and financial institutions and turned over economic policy to the Wall Street friends of Larry Summer and Tim Geithner led to the dismantling of its own basis. Since there was and still is no independent leftist formation that could articulate the popular anger, the terrain was immediately occupied by the Tea Party, which redirected people's resentment from Wall Street to Washington. That is, against the federal government and its taxes and spending and federal directive, you name it. Liberals and leftists could not imagine that a mass movement like Occupy Wall Street could emerge and develop in such a short time. 1 month after the occupation of Zuccotti Park, the hegemonic landscape had changed considerably. According to a poll of late October 2011, 43% of US citizens agreed with the views of the Occupy Wall Street movement, compared to an approval rating of 9% for Congress at the same time. This was obviously a huge shift in a very short time period. I think there are several reasons for this success, and I will only enumerate a few. A first reason is that from the beginning, by occupying the Zuccotti Park, the activists showed a combination of boldness, inclusiveness, inventiveness that captured the imagination, and people could also see that these guys were able to persevere against all the odds. The second reason is, and that is less discussed in the literature in my view, is that from the outset Occupy Wall Street built relationships with community groups, with anti-poverty initiatives, immigrant rights organizations, church communities, and not least with trade unions. So there was this interesting combination of the capacity of rupture, disruption, and a broadness of alliance building. I find that combination very interesting, and something beyond what we've seen before. On the one hand, the revolutionaries; on the other hand, the reformers. Here we have an interesting new combination. For example, it sent its activists to the headquarters of the telephone company Verizon to show solidarity with the communication workers' strike. And on the other hand, then several trade unions supported Occupy Wall Street, and some of them picked up the Occupy slogans for their own struggles, especially the National Nurses United. So there was, all in all, a kind of a relation of mutual strengthening or mutual reinforcement. And by that kind of outreach strategy, Occupy Wall Street was able to spread to poor, predominantly black and Hispanic neighborhoods. I mean, it's clear it was from the beginning a predominantly white movement, but it had the capacity to spread out and to help organize actions against evictions and foreclosure auctions, etc. A third reason was that by its main slogan, We Are the 99%, Occupy Wall Street created a new framework of unity and communality that stood out against the long US tradition of single-issue movements and identity politics. It broke down a taboo that has dominated the political discourse on the left for a long time, namely the postmodernist command, you shall not invoke a collective identity. Occupy Wall Street did that, and I find this is a boldness, it's an audacity to do that. In Gramscian terms, this slogan, We Are the 99%, can be understood as a shorthand for a broad historical bloc comprising not only the subaltern classes, but also the so-called middle classes, which on the one hand are increasingly hit by precarization and poverty, and on the other hand are to a large part still entrapped in the illusion to be more on the side of the elites than on the side of the people. So by creating this broad framework, Occupy Wall Street was able to connect to people's common sense and to shift it considerably to the left. I'd like to reflect a little bit on that last point, the common sense, because we are dealing here with a key concept of Gramsci's theory of hegemony. According to Gramsci, people's sense of commune, normally translated as common sense, is characterized by its contradictory and incoherent composition, of which people, we, are usually unaware. Everyone who wants to change people's mind or to raise consciousness needs to be aware that people's common sense is multiple, heterogeneous, and contradictory. One needs to identify what needs to identify, according to Gramsci, what he called buon senso, a good sense, which is the most realistic, the most experimental, open to experience component of common sense. And his idea is that we have, as organic intellectuals of the subaltern classes, that we have the task to identify this kind of realistic core of good sense and to work from there in order to render common sense more coherent. This is, by the way, another idea than the Lenin idea and Kautsky idea of bringing class consciousness to the masses from the outside. I find this is another approach, even if the controversy has never been spelled out explicitly for clear reasons, historical reasons. Now, if we look at the current economic crisis, one can distinguish roughly, and it's certainly a simplification, two or three major ways by which people's experiences are being translated into popular common sense. The first is, and still predominant, is a neoliberal version that the fiscal debt is not sustainable, that the government is driving the country to ruin by spending too much, in particular by giving the money to the wrong people, to the black minorities, to the ghettos, to the public teachers, to the trade unions, and so on. A second layer of common sense, more akin to Gramsci's concept of good sense, manifests itself as an awareness of the income polarity between rich and poor, and this is being seen as unsustainable, something not okay, usually articulated in moral terms, moral is scandalous, often attributed to the greed of the bankers, and maybe also to some mistakes in on the level of politics. And I would say there is a third component, or two and a half maybe, because it's weaker, kind of underneath, there's a growing suspicion that capitalism itself might not be sustainable. And this third layer of common sense, however, remains mostly latent and blocked by fear of being ostracized as lunacy and by the lack of a credible democratic socialist alternative so far. Now, it's important to note that, according to Gramsci again, that the different layers that I just enumerated are not separate. They can intermingle, and they usually do, within the same group of people and within the same individual. And that the same person can vent their anger simultaneously at the fat cats and at other parts of the lower classes. That's the point where racism and sexism comes in. Against this backdrop, one can better understand how Occupy Wall Street intervened into the common sense and changed its inner composition. In my analysis, it was able to do both, to mobilize the second layer, so to say, the moral outrage against social injustice, and to bring an anti-capitalist, an explicitly anti-capitalist layer to the forefront that is normally lying dormant. It was able to mobilize the good sense parts within common sense, one could say this with Gramsci's terminology. And it made clear that there are enormous potentials for a possible leftist alternative under the condition that this alternative is formulated in an accessible way and that it can be kept alive. I transition now quickly to the weaknesses or some of the limits of Occupy Wall Street. It's certainly true that the movement's achievements should not be underestimated or belittled. On the other hand, we need a realistic assessment that understands that changing the public discourse or the symbolic order is not the same as changing the real power relations, either in both the economy and also in the hegemonic apparatuses. These power relations have not changed in the realm of politics. We have still the two-party monopoly in the realm of the corporate media. Not really. Now, what has changed is the symbolic order. And it's not to denounce Occupy Wall Street or to belittle, but that's an attempt to a realistic assessment. I agree with Francis that Occupy Wall Street has to be understood as a part of a new cycle of movement, which started in the Arab Spring, and I think there's more to come. Whether that is then Occupy or one of its successors is another question. But I think we have also to realistically see that Occupy Wall Street has huge problems to find another point of coalitions and of visibility. Disruption is also a limited power, in my view. It's an important... I don't think that we have a real controversy. I'm just bending the stick a little bit in the other direction. I think what's missing in the US is mainly a political formation of the left that is strictly independent from the two-party monopoly, that is both open to the many different approaches of social movements and also sufficiently coherent to bring these differences together and to translate them into a convincing political alternative. And you can see the difference if you compare the situation in the US and some European countries. I do not generalize for Europe in general, that would be nonsensical. But in some European countries, you can observe an intense and productive interplay between social movements, trade unions, and leftist parties. Instead of the old splits and animosities, there are more and more relations of mutual reinforcement. This applies, for instance, to Spain, where the Occupy movement of the Indignados strongly influenced the strategy of the trade unions, which became more and more combative and militant. And it also, the Indignados also reactivated the membership of the leftist party coalition, Izquierda Unida, which in turn, and as a reaction to that, opened its electoral lists for movement activists and more than doubled its electoral votes. So you have a synergy effect there. And the most significant example is, of course, Greece, where the leftist party coalition Syriza succeeded in assembling the impulses of the social movement into a coherent political alternative, which in June 2012 garnered almost 27% of the popular vote. Social movements and leftist parties have learned from another or are in the process of learning from another. It's certainly a contradictory process. More and more movement activists understand that they need allies in the political domain and also in the parliamentary system, and that a general refusal of party politics helps only the most conservative and reactionary parties. The left parties do not longer claim to represent the movement, but define themselves predominantly as connective parties. The general effect of that kind of interplay is, in my perception, that the social movement itself has a stronger political consistency, which can be seen in the Ultra Summit now that takes place in June 7th to 9th in Athens. I understand well that the concept of political party is kind of scary in the context of leftist politics in the US, because we all know the problems. The undemocratic electoral system in the US, the project of a party risks to split the left before it can even gather the critical mass. Now, just one side remark, and I will shorten that here because I'm running out of time, don't I?
Yeah, you have a few more minutes.
Okay. When we look back to Gramsci, it's interesting to see that he discussed and developed this concept of party not in that kind of superficial electoral, predominantly electoral sense that we are discussing it now. Do we have a chance? No, we don't have a chance, so let it be. For Gramsci, the concept of the political party signifies the task of organizing and constructing an entire active social bloc. He described the party as a collective intellectual by which social groups elaborate their own categories of organic intellectuals directly in the political and philosophical field. The party is the organism that wields, that brings together the organic intellectuals and the traditional intellectuals. And the party marks a point where movements can overcome their spontaneous corporatism. Corporatism meaning their immediate goals that they have, and they can develop a kind of attitude or kind of a strategy that is able to align themselves with other subordinate groups. So that's what he meant basically when he talked about party. I'm not pleading, of course, for rebuilding of the centralized and top-down vanguard party, which in a way reduplicated the chains of command of Fordism, as Antonio Negri has observed. The most successful leftist parties today represent a more network-like type of political party, often discussed as connective party. What is at stake is not just the party question as such, but the party question as part of a larger project, namely the project of a multi-pronged strategy or a multi-level strategy in which social movements, trade unions, and leftist parties constitute a kind of mosaic, both multiple and coordinated, a heterogeneous political agent. Now, and come back to Occupy Wall Street. I think one of the structural weaknesses of Occupy Wall Street movement, and that's not their fault, obviously, is that the component of a political formation in the US is lacking. Occupy Wall Street has itself not mustered the will and the capacity to initiate its own autonomous progressive organization of a new type, a kind of connective party. I think this is one of the reasons why it is not yet possible, or it was not so possible so far, to transform Occupy Wall Street's momentary disruption of neoliberal hegemony into a more sustainable counter-hegemony. There is a strange contradiction, in my view, between the ambitious claim to construct a broad social bloc of the 99% and the fact that this proclamation, this audacious proclamation, is not backed up by a coherent political and organizational strategy, so that the components of Occupy Wall Street relapse again and again into dispersion and fragmentation against their will. This might change again, so I'm maybe similarly optimistic to Francis' account, maybe in another way. Rosa, I will end with a quote of Rosa Luxemburg. Rosa Luxemburg observed in Russia, that in Russia of 1905, the new organizations were born from the mass strikes. So it was not that the organizations were there and then was a mass strike. There was a mass strike, and then out of that mass strike started a feverish work of organization, end quote. And I hope that Occupy Wall Street could become the starting point of a new leftist formation. I prefer to speak about a leftist formation instead of throwing in that catchword of a party, but because I'm not fixated on the electoral level. Could be, could not be, depending on the regional and local conditions. I think such an open-minded, non-sectarian leftist formation could then in turn strengthen and re-encourage the movements on the ground.
So, thanks so much to our three panelists. We're now going to have Doug Henwood, our discussant, respond to you and give us his thoughts.
Yeah, I don't really have very much to say since I like most of what I heard and don't really feel like picking fights or anything.
I
will make a couple of observations, which were inspired by what I heard. The 99% concept was ingenious. It was really a brilliant marketing ploy, just obviously was contagious. It does elide a lot of problems. Interests of people at the 90th percentile are often very different from those at the 10th percentile. So there are a lot of substantial divisions within that 99% that get papered over by invoking that near universality, that universality minus 1%. I think ties in with the ideological confusion a lot of Occupy. There was people didn't, they sort of knew what they were against. They're against inequality, they're against polarization, they're against state support of the rich at the expense of everyone else. But it was kind of lacking a positive vision of anything. And prefiguration is a nice idea, but people had to go to Home Depot to get tarps at Zuccotti Park. And I think that ties into a problem of that people really weren't thinking about scale. I mean, this idea that you were somehow prefiguring a better society by getting together in a park is very tempting. And in my visits there, it was just a marvelous place to visit. Just so energetic. And there were a lot of tremendous conversations going on and new friendships and a lot of education and thinking and argument, and it was just an inspiring thing. And while it was really active, it was great to be able to say, certainly I'm too old to sleep on the concrete, but it was really great to go and watch and listen and admire. But there was this difficulty about articulating or even figuring out what the thing was for. Now Fran mentioned earlier movements like the civil rights movement, the populists, the labor movement. They were very clear in many ways what they were against and also what they were for. The civil rights movement wanted to end Jim Crow. The labor union wanted to screw the boss and get higher wages. The populists had a very, very detailed agenda, which they developed over decades and created a lot of organizations to press it. And they're also the populists, and all these were rooted in a very identifiable demographic, rural farmers or whatever. The diversity of the 99% thing makes it difficult to articulate a common set of goals. And on top of that, you have this this reluctance from a lot of American social movements to articulate anything that sounded like a demand. I remember that the great debate over whether to make demands or not, and people would say things like, we are our own demands, which is marvelously tautological, but I'm not sure what it accomplishes. The reluctance to engage with the state. I just read George Cicarello Marr's book on Venezuela under Chavez, We Created Him. It was one of the points that George makes, and he's around here somewhere this weekend, so I don't know if you've seen or heard him, but a central point of the book is that Chavez emerged from a bunch of social movements, but then his assumption of state power actually enabled the social movements to flourish. There was a real complicated relationship of critique and support with the social movements and the state under Chavez's days in Venezuela. Some of these social movements were armed and often did some damage to opponents of the regime, which the regime was ambivalent about. But in Latin America, a lot of the left there is much less reluctant to engage with the state or dream of transforming the state. And I think that people who see Chavez as some sort of old style Latin strongman or whatever caricature people like, to really miss the importance of that relationship between state and popular movements. He has a footnote in the book, which is very tempting, and I want to look further into it, but he says that a lot of Argentines were very, who created the co-ops and such, were very critical of the way they were read by North American leftists, in particular a bunch of people collectively wrote a letter of protest to Naomi Klein over her film, The Tape, because they're not anti-state. There is, I think, some kind of complex relationship between the cooperatives and the state that gets lost and comes up to the north, rises above the Rio Grande. It seems that there's this, that it gets infected by this American hostility towards engaging with the state. So the fact that they are now creating these kinds, or some people are trying to create kind of worker cooperatives, is interesting and encouraging. But you know, it's going to require more than just a bunch of people getting together and creating these little things. You need financing institutions. You need something to make these co-ops, you know, viable. And again, then we get to the scale question. The idea that you can have a complex industrial society on the face-to-face scale a lot of people in and around Occupy seem to think you could. I don't think they've really thought through what it takes to get, you know, the laptops that they all loved and the phones they all used. It's interesting how much they focused on debt as well. Now, in some way, that's almost reproducing the elite concern with debt. You know, all the elites can talk about these days is, you know, federal debt and deficits. And in some ways, I think they're kind of reproducing that. There's this long-standing obsession with finance in the American populist tradition that sort of doesn't really look much at how finance connects to the real world, how finance connects to production and consumption and distribution. So the reason I have so much student debt is because education is commodified. You know, the reason we have all this health medical debt is because, you know, healthcare is commodified. The housing market is a very debased thing that creates a lot of mortgage debt. But there's a focus on just the debt without talking about the things that debt is used to finance. And I think that touches upon the reluctance to engage with the state also. Because when you talk about healthcare, you want some sort of state provision of public health care. You want some kind of state provision of free education. Some state regulation of housing or the creation of public housing. All these things, I think, led to a reluctance to talk about how debt is connected to a lot of other things. Parenthetically, it's very interesting. I don't know how widely known this is, but the Federal Reserve Bank of New York invited David Graeber down for a chat sometime about a year ago. So there is, apparently, according to his account, the Fed people were very interested in the idea of some kind of debt relief because they think the economy can't sustain the level of debt that we're under. And the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has now been issuing new data on student debt, which is something that for which there was no good data before. So somehow the Occupy thing seems to have changed some minds at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is not one thinks of as a hotbed of revolutionary challenges to the existing system. But you know, now we look back on it, and you know, it's clearly it caused the power structure to quiver a bit. There was certainly a discursive quiver. I remember this cover of the New Yorker, like two months or so after the occupation began, that was all about the 1%. I think, man, it's reached the level of the New Yorker cover. Now this is really, you know, this is doing something. But you know, the symbolic order now seems to have mostly recovered from this challenge. I'm sad to say. It was a really exciting moment when people were talking about different things. There's a saying in the public opinion business that we can't tell people what to think, but we can tell them what to think about. And I think, you know, what Occupy did in its moment of real flourishing was to get people to think about different things, talk about different things. But you know, I think Jan is right to point to the lack of an organization that can sustain that. You know, and it seems to me the big challenge of doing politics in this country is creating some kinds of new organizational forms that are not. You know, we have to get over our Lenin phobia. You know, like it's every organization doesn't have to turn into Stalin's CP, Stalin's Communist Party. You know, it's. Needing something that's flexible, but also something that can actually have some institutional form and go on beyond the moment, so that it to engage with the state. There is this, you know, as Jody Dean argues, there's this like fear of representation that we all suffer from. She traces it back to the days of the New Left, when no one wanted to speak on someone else's behalf. And that you got that in the Occupy. I mean, there's like everyone has to speak for him or herself, and no one wanted to speak for anyone else. Which meant for very, very long meetings and a real self-selecting population of people who could put up with that. Most people can't put up with that. I tried going to this demands working group, and it took 2 hours to set the agenda. And the park was closing at midnight. It was about 6:30, and people were worried that the meeting would have to be over by the time the park closed. I thought, man, this is not for me. So I think that's part of the reason there's so many people in their 20s in a movement like that, I guess. But yeah, I think that the organization question is really, really important. And so are our demands, I think. Like having an agenda is really important. The successful movements that we're talking about in American political history had organizations, had demands, and wanted to engage with the state. And I always think of that quote of Karl Kraus about psychoanalysis, that it's the disease of which it purports to be the cure. This fear of organization is really, I think, in some sense, kind of pathological and needs to be gotten over somehow. I don't know how. But all these criticisms aside, I certainly miss Occupy badly. I draw a cheer from Fran's observation that this is a part of a long wave of social movement, and not it was just one wave in a long series of them, and I hope she's right, and I hope that there's more of this coming in the future. And one reason I think there may be something to that is that kids today there are a lot of really great kids today. I read one poll, a pollster who wrote something about a report in the millennial generation a couple of years ago, and said it's the most progressive cohort in the history of public opinion research, and on all kinds of issues, like economic, cultural, political, all sorts of issues. And people don't change their beliefs all that much as they age. Most people don't get profoundly more conservative as they age. So it's very cheering to think that there is this rising cohort that produce something like Occupy, and they're going to be around and getting stronger and moving into positions of influence. So I think there's a lot of bogus crap around generational conflict, but in this case, there's a lot of encouragement to draw from what this younger generation looks like, and I just want to sit back and listen and learn from that.